My name is Gregory Sinyanko, and I am an independent researcher. I want to thank all the listeners of my lecture who are willing to dig into quite a difficult topic. So the stated topic of my talk is formulated as a question: what are the pitfalls of radical ontology or metaphysics? In my report, I will try to touch upon the problems of understanding the category which in different philosophical systems is called as non-being, totally other, impossible, abyss, and so on. And of course, I'm not going to state that the philosophical systems using such concepts are saying the same thing. On the contrary, I believe that almost every author or tradition puts their unique meanings into these categories. However, what interests me is to emphasize a certain general metaphysical intention, which can be found when talking about such categories. Moreover, this intention, in my opinion, has not yet received a satisfactory formulation in a speculative, rather than poetic way, in any of the doctrines known to me. Also, the question that interests me can be formulated not only as I've done it before. One may ask oneself, what should the speculative discourse about the most radically understood transcendence look like? In Yuri Mamleev's words, the discourse about the true transcendence. Here, using the word speculative, according to Quentin Meyesu, I mean at least a consistent fixation of all presuppositions introduced when discussing a certain issue, and, in addition, a certain clarity of the structure of our argumentation. Approaching the issue speculatively, we first of all begin our movement as skeptics. We bear in mind the understanding of the epistemological non-necessity of all our judgments and presumptions, consistently fixing them before our next thesis follows. It is precisely that kind of methodology, in my opinion, that wasn't applied to mentioned question as successfully as could be, unlike poetic way of thinking. Let's also define the concept of radical. To put it strictly, a necessary condition for being radical for any issue will be the inevitability of working with contradictions when discussing it. Moreover, contradictions not of a dialectical, but of a logical nature, such as the property of an object to be such and not such at the same time, and not in the sense of alternation of one property by the opposite, but in an unimaginable way, at the precisely same time. The radical destroys the boundaries of the ordinary mind. For example, all variants of the contradictory discourse about God, where he, like in Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, is the truth, but at the same time is not the truth, are examples of radical discourse. Let me, as for this first step, say that in my work I prefer to use the word everything to address, well, everything in the most total sense, and the word abyss to address the radical category, which should escape from inevitable inclusion into everything. I use the word abyss as a synonym for the true transcendence, in Mamleev's words. We should also bear in mind that this is a short lecture, so I can only show what I find unsatisfactory in some philosophical systems that were close to this question and, using an extremely limited amount of authors, show that the grounds for my statement can be found. I also think that this discourse can only be brought to life in dialogue. Therefore, without expanding this requirement to the field of politics, personal practice, and teleology in general, I would ask for some tolerance towards the most different ways of thinking related to this question. No matter how marginal or dangerous or even banal someone's ideas may seem to us, by the very fact of engagement in the question about the abyss, any thought gets the right to exist or the right to be considered. Of course, everything that will be further expressed by me is just my lens, an illustration that serves to raise a certain question, which I think is undeservedly forgotten. Therefore, I can make some mistakes and not take into account all the nuances of the author's views, especially considering the fact that I work with discourses based on contradictions. Now, what is important to us is not the accuracy of the historical presentation, which can be completed afterwards, but the thought of a purely abstract nature. The thought according to which the question of the abyss of non-being has not yet received the proper speculative development. My thought, of course, is not considered by me as a unique insight. On the contrary, I would be glad to know that some system of thought has already said about the same thing, and on the same level of speculative purity. So far, however, all the systems I have found that dealt with this topic do not seem to me completely satisfactory. And I will even formulate it like this. The discourse about radical metaphysics or ontology in the context of their touch of non-being, abyss, or totally other, and so on, exists and is quite large, is quite developed, but today it has not been brought to that version of speculative purity that the current state of philosophy has to offer. I will rely on a critical analysis of four very different authors. This is Yuri Mamleev with his work The Destiny of Being, and in particular its chapter The Last Doctrine. This is Haydar Cemal with his central writing Orientation North. There are two representatives of the Yuzhinsky Circle, well known among traditionalists. For me personally, the place in which Russian philosophy claimed its ability to focus on extremely deep metaphysics. It is also Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, a classic of apophatic theology and the most titled author among the considered, both by the academy and by powerful social institutions, in particular, titled by the church itself. Here we will not discuss the question of how this pseudo may be removed to refer to a famous saint. And at the end of our list, I have placed Matthew Whiteman, an almost unknown New Age Gnostic of a clearly counter-initiatory orientation. But we will start not with the history of philosophy, but with my own speculative approach. So, the concept of properties is quite important for my intuition. This concept, although introduced for the sake of clarity of my reasoning, still fits poorly on rigorous formulas, but I can try to define it by the induction. Everything to which we will give at least some characteristic, everything to which we will turn a certain kind of practice, including, for example, the practice of sacred silence, is a priori will have the property. The property of conformity to a given characteristic, or the property of being the object of someone's specific practice. So the semantic content of the property in this case does not matter. Our statement generates properties. Everything that we will never think about at all will have the property of not thinking about it at all. Everything that is inaccessible to us has a corresponding property. We can say that any language always talks about properties and byproperties. The property can be expressed by an adjective, for example, black, endless, unimaginable, disappeared, deceased, impossible, by a noun, for example, apple or God, and in general by any kind of saying. It would seem that the lack of distinction between substance and property is quite controversial here. However, the given apple and the property of being a given apple is no different. When we say the first, we always mean the second. So let us clarify that once again. I use the word property not only in the sense of property of something like being green or yellow or tasty, but in the sense of any statement in general. So I use this term also towards nouns and towards any sentence. This is just my vocabulary. However, there is a trap here, of course. We cannot continue this argument, this speculation, without making a few comments about the philosophy of the language itself. First, according to the common view, any philosophy, by definition, exists only in language. Any linguistic reasoning is simultaneously limited by being itself and, at the same time, claims to be a mean of access to the absolute of everything. What do I mean by that? We can pronounce the word everything, and its meaning is limitless, but on the other hand, it's only a word of our language, yes? So, the most interesting thing begins when the language tries to break out of its own boundaries, dictating a general ontological order of reality. So, even if we say the phrase, quote, "What is expressed in the language is not equal to how things are outside the language," end quote. If we refer to the inaccessible by language, affirming at least that this inaccessible exists, we may not notice, concentrating on the mystical content of these combinations of words, the fact that they did not leave the space of language. The dissonance that arises in us when we face such a problem is the dissonance of the logical contradiction. Such sentences as, quote, "possesses a property and is radically inaccessible to our language and thoughts," end quote, are contradictory. This does not mean that such a being does not exist. It only means that the statement about its existence, as formulated in the language, contradicts the property also attributed to it by the language. This is nonsense to our mind. It is impossible to draw adequate conclusions about it being true or false. A similar question is to what extent a language which is used for speaking, for example, about the practice of sacred silence, dissolves it in itself as something that it has already referred to, as mentioned by the language and as done after the considerations and reasoning that we came to through the language. For example, for comprehending God. What do I mean by that? We can decide that for understanding of God, of apophatic God, we need to practice sacred silence. But the problem is that our decision was made using the language. And the second problem is that our meditation will be a meditation, a silence about something, because we have already derived that as a way of comprehending God, and we were using language for that. The answer here, fortunately, can again be given only within the framework of the language. So, however, to some extent, this applies to any action at all, for example, eating an apple. In other words, we can assume that our very action of eating an apple and the feelings that arise in this case are not limited to expressing them by the language. However, we can formulate it only in language, which makes this sentence itself meaningless to a certain extent. This is an aporia. Therefore, as philosophers, we should always remember that all our conclusions are derived from the language and thus, in a certain sense, are radically different from the possible non-linguistic consequences of our practices. However, speaking about this radical difference is possible only in language, and we cannot get out of this cell. My clarifications will always take the form of aporias. And at this stage, the speculative philosopher has two options, either to immediately admit that language has its own boundaries set by that nonsense regarding the content of some paradoxes of itself, or try to carry out attribution to properties for such paradoxes despite their content. That is, the phrase, quote, "this is a phrase that is not a property," end quote, can be perceived in two ways, either mystically agree with some unclear and yet meaningless message. It is itself a phrase that is by definition is a property, so how can it forbid attributing itself to properties? And then stop in philosophical speculation. On the other hand, we can simply say that this is another paradox, the same as many others, and the paradoxes regarding language are nothing special compared to any others, and they are also properties. So, in that case, it should be pointed out that no matter how much we talk about an quote, infinitely inaccessible being even through these phrases, end quote, we do not go beyond the properties. In this case, philosophy as a strange endless thinking still continues to have its value. In the first case, it should not be of interest. In second case, it has its value as far as it can proceed the endless process of including all thoughts into a certain total category. In our case, it is category named the everything. And then, arriving at the extremely meaningless question of radical transcendence by setting it relatively to the absolute of the everything. That is how the question of the abyss can be formulated. First, we should make a total category of everything, putting, well, everything to it, and then ask ourselves what cannot be put there, what can still not be put there. So let me give some last speculative statements. As a first approximation, when I say everything, I am talking about all properties altogether. In a quite similar total sense, this term everything can be found in the works of Quentin Meursault and Ray Brassier, but not as total as in my case. I consider all the properties without any limitations, so everything is a construct that includes any statement, object, description, any metaphysical system which can contradict to the other. Of course, the absence of a specific property is also a property. The question of whether the absence of all properties is considered to be the usual inversion of the presence of all properties is controversial. However, in the form in which the very phrase "the absence of all properties" has at least some meaning, it will also refer to everything. Speaking of the abyss, I am talking about the fruit of the Gnostic intuition, which wants to speculatively leave my construct of all properties, of everything, get out of it, regardless of the fact that all is constantly absorbed by the everything. We can try to start our meditation on this concept with, mentioned earlier, the absence of all properties. But we should remember that if we do see any sign, any sense in this description, we are certainly in a trap of everything. It is the abyss that I call the last hole, the last question of any metaphysical and or ontological speculation. That is right. Heideggerian difference between being and beings, or in other words, between ontological and ontic, is an absolutely important and radical question, but it does not seem to me as the last question. There is one more, the question about unbeing, about abyss, about something out of being at all, about, so to speak, radical transcendence. Therefore, in terms of Heidegger, my category called everything includes the radical difference between being and beings in itself, includes but not forgets about it. We should think of everything not as of an array of different things and or laws. This is an array of all metaphysical descriptions or thoughts, of all ontological systems. Moreover, everything could not be interpreted as Neoplatonic one, for example, because in its oneness it contains its non-nonness, a total multiplicity, and also not their synthesis, but only unity and only multiplicity. This is an extremely difficult speculation based on contradictions, and it should be based on contradictions, which cannot be explained in this one lecture. But do remember, if we are looking into everything, we will find there any ontological or metaphysical system. It does not matter if it will be Heideggerian being, Christian metaphysics, God of Islamic monotheism, or naive realism, or the word green, for example. They are all These are all parts of everything. All these different words with their senses. Or, as I said before, all properties. As we should understand, everything is not a naive Hegelian construct, which stands upon the correspondence of signifier to signified, or on any hope to limit the limitless. But this construct functions in a way that is always in movement towards producing another everything, in correspondence to denial of it. We know that we can always say, but let us imagine a category which is beyond all our thoughts, all our words, all our ontological boundaries, and right after that we will remember that it was pronounced with help of a language, so there is an opportunity of birth of a new, even more absurd everything that will include in itself that category which successfully escaped from the previous everything. So in that constant development exists this concept, and exactly from such rules of a game the abyss wants to escape. An easier task will not be truly the last question of metaphysics or ontology. So I am making the most total concept from what I can do, and only after that I'm trying to question, is it still possible to escape from that? And this question is the question about the abyss. But we cannot continue that in that time. What I want to say is that, in any case, now any property, except for the above paradoxical absence of all properties, can be easily attributed to everything, which at least will allow me to accumulate under this signifier the layers of the most diverse metaphysical doctrines that thought of non-being or the abyss as something that has some kind of certain properties, even if they are frightening or unimaginable, which seems to be a demonstration of the very useful classification tool for metaphysics. When I will find any certain properties in any category, which could be an analog of the abyss in my understanding, I will call it a property mistake. So let's start with the analysis of Mamleev's essay, The Destiny of Being. Let's try to understand whether Mamleev's idea of the abyss is successful. The author, of course, was able to successfully direct his thought towards a radical idea, crystallizing the requests for the truly transcendental in considerable purity. In confirmation, it is enough to cite several fragments from the analyzed text. So he writes, "The idea of the truly transcendent and not false based on ignorance is at the same time the cornerstone of human existence, but very strange. Indeed, we can say that a person always strives to go beyond the achieved, beyond the realized. But can one go beyond the boundaries of God, beyond the boundaries of the absolute? After all, on condition of God realization, a person identifies himself with God. So how can he or she go beyond that? But still, what does it mean to go beyond God?" Mamleev writes, "Beyond the absolute. God is, first of all, absolute reality, absolute being, and going out beyond the absolute would mean going beyond the limits of any reality in general. This going beyond reality also means going beyond what is the source of reality, the source of being, that is beyond the limits of the so-called divine nothing, which is equivalent to the divine fullness containing all the potentials of being, and which, although it is on the other side of being, is its source and foundation. Being is contained in the divine nothing in its unmanifest hidden potential state, and the divine on the other side of being and the divine being are metaphysically one, forming the same nature of God. So the last doctrine is a teaching about what is not, about what lies on the other side of God, other side of absolute, about what is transcendental in relation to God, to reality, and to the higher self. But after that, Mamleev makes a lot of property mistakes, which can be seen from the other quotes. The previous quotes was, from my point of view, quite successful. But what he says next? This is the teaching that God is only the body of the truly transcendent, speaking by analogy, and not the essence of the transcendent. The latter is, as it were, the true darkness, the true ocean that surrounds reality. In relation to God, this darkness is the same as the spirit in relation to the body. Of course, taking into account that such an analogy is purely external in nature. In addition, although it is obvious that entering into the practice of the last doctrine, into its world, so to speak, through the intellect, including the divine, since intellect belongs to the sphere of reality, is impossible. But first, in the intellect, some theoretical presentiment of this doctrine can be found, and second, in the intellect, some knowledge of the threshold to this doctrine is given. Since this threshold is related to the real world, to the world of the absolute, but in connection with something that does not exist. Therefore, the last doctrine breaks down, as it were, into two parts. First, the first, which can still be expressed in the intellect, and the second, basic and practical, the essence of which is beyond everything that is given to man and God. So, what can we see here? From the first quote, we can see that an analogy of metaphysical nesting doll, where the abyss is proposed to be comprehended as a banal layer of everything, simply in some unthinkable way surrounding the reality, which includes the absolute. Of course, Mamleev often points out the inevitable imperfection of his words and analogies. However, the analogy is used, and analogy is radically unsuccessful. The second quotation, as we can see, offers two aspects of initiation into the last doctrine. And if the first of them can be considered quite admissible for consideration, since it refers to the status of the thought of the abyss realized within everything, then the second, does it really imply some practice? Unfortunately, this becomes clear if read further. The author has given to the abyss completely certain properties. Even if something is totally strange, very distant, and never attainable, it has the properties described by these words. Mamleev writes, at the same time, in the abyss, in the trans darkness, the principle of the self-reference, the principle of being, does not exist. Everything, as it were, becomes overworldly, is overworldly to itself. This complete overworldliness in relation to oneself, absolute absence of immanence, means, among other things, the absence of being, and it defines a new principle, the principle of the night. Leaving the sphere of analogy, we can add that no intellect, including the divine, can imagine this no, this abyss. For this, there must be something fundamentally different, a different organ that, thanks to which, we can come into direct contact with the abyss. And everything that belongs to the sphere of genuine, practical, and not theoretical contact, more precisely anti-contact between this being and the abyss, is beyond the description on the language and even in the silence of the absolute, in the language and silence of our world. Since initiation, the last initiation is made in relation to something that does not exist, there can be no question of possession or realization, which would be the essence of ordinary dedication. Mamleev, of course, does not claim that the abyss can be reached in the usual sense. On the contrary, the text postulates the principle of eternal transcendence. However, he points out the possibility of endless movement towards the abyss, and even mentions some anti-contact. Can we really think that there is no radically unattainable part in everything? Such unattainability is only a property, and the Mamleev abyss is only a dark unattainable ocean, in fact swallowed by the everything in my understanding. The speech about some kind of anti-contact of the creature of the abyss with the abyss, the definition of the abyss as unattainable, the definition of the abyss as the antagonism of everything, or, for example, as a notion that feels something that is outside everything. All these are property mistakes. An important problem in Mamleev's reasoning is also the identification of the ominous or lower character of the periphery from which the path to the abyss begins. So let's see what he writes. Consequently, although the practical initiation into the abyss itself lies on the other side of the expressible, it is possible, however, to say something, since this is still contained in the intellect, about the first phase of true initiation, that is, about the exit of the liberated personality from the whole and its departure to the periphery. This retreat is, as we said, a complete positivation of all negations, evil and death, as cracks into the abyss. It means the first indirect contact with the abyss through the recognition of the world and the transfiguration of reality, on which after that the seal of the abyss will already lie. In my opinion, the fact that any evil or death are purely states that belong to everything, and they should not be privileged among any other states, is quite obvious, so that's a property mistake. Thus, Mamleev received a rare insight and was able to open up the question of the metaphysical limit, but he could not avoid the property mistakes like many others. So let's talk about Hidar Jamal. Hidar Jamal is a prominent Islamic philosopher, but his most famous writing, Orientation North, can be read in isolation from Islamic theology. If we introduce the philosophy of the late Jamal as briefly as possible without touching upon the status of subject, then the general line of his thought will be the insistence on a fundamental distinction between consistent monotheism and Guinonian perennialism, and in general various forms of teachings about God at the highest concentration of all forms of being. Jamal's monotheism is a doctrine of radical opposition. God is radically not identical with the world, is extremely apophatic, and the only one directly opposite to the cataphatic unification of the all. Through the prophets sent from the hidden God, a person receives revelation as a guide to true liberation, as evidence of a duality rooted not in the harmony of oppositions with being, but in the duality of the androgynous all and the apophatic other, what Islam calls the direct path, as opposed to the concentric rotation and eternal return of one and the same ignorant great being. Linear history in his context acquires a special status, as presupposing the final, in contrast to the pagan, infinitely meaningless fluctuations of the beginning of the world and its collapsing into nothing, and then beginning again. At the same time, criticism of such a view, in the light of the methodology proposed by me, becomes quite obvious and does not need a long explanation. The very speaking through the prophets, that is, the participation of God in a certain plan for humanity, is certainly a property. The appearance of the Creator, even in the most unimaginable sense of our wretched mind, is a property. Being not identical to something, irreducibility to something, is also a property. Thus, even so understood God, who is radical opposition to everything, is taken, it is eaten by a non-naively introduced category of everything, which presupposes an inner ultimate inconsistency and contradiction. In other words, Jamal's God, a radical luxury in front of everything, and opposition to everything, becomes absorbed by the new everything that is formed from contradicting metaphysical systems. In the everything, which is the totality of all properties, and precisely in the sense of the word property that I gave earlier. Now let's turn to orientation north. In this format, it is impossible to analyze all the metaphysical statements of Jamal, so we will focus only on a few. From the very first lines of the book, it becomes clear that Jamal is planning to make a property mistake. Chapter Absolute. Let's see what he writes. The relation of reality to the absolute is a universal problem of the spirit. Depending on the solution of this problem, the fate of the very authenticity of the spirit is decided. If reality as a whole is indeed absolute, spirit is ephemeral. Such a conclusion is inevitable since the specificity of the spirit lies in its claim to some peculiarity. This peculiarity of the spirit consists in its non-identification with the element of global inertia. Obviously, in view of the thirst for such peculiarity brought to an ontological level, Jamal will postulate a certain dualism. We can see that later. So how does Jamal carry out his totalization, to which then he will introduce the category of other that will be an opposition? So here is his totalization. Reality is that which has an experience or relative to which experience is possible. Any possible state of reality is ultimately based on the principle of experience. Thus, reality as a whole is nothing more than a total expression of the principle of experience. Consciousness, knowledge, and experience are the three models of manifestation of this principle. This means that only that which is related to the experience is related to being. Experience, as an unconditional criterion of the real, always contains an indication of this. Thus, the reality that totally embodies the principle of experience is always this. So there is a problem here. In my opinion, such an insufficiently total definition of the category to which the other will act as an opposition will ultimately lead to an insufficient otherness of the other. Jamal writes the following about the other. The essence of the opposition of the spirit in relation to reality, which is this, lies in the fact that the spirit carries in itself the thought of something else. It is, in its most general form, the thought implies that which is not controlled by the principle of experience. That which is outside the relationship to experience is outside experience, knowledge, and consciousness. From the point of view of the principle of experience, the other is exactly what is not. The negative status of the other in relation to the principle of experience is expressed in the fact that the other is given precisely through the absence of experience, in zero experience. Thus, only the true absolute can have the quality of excess. Since the self-sufficient fullness of reality is not absolute, the absolute that is in excess is unconditionally unreal. The equality of the real and the possible presupposes the equality of the absolute and metaphysical impossibility. Since reality is determined by the principle of experience, the absolute presupposes in relation to itself a simple and pure absence of experience. Thus, the absolute is all other that has no contact with the reality. Reality, as an integral unity of all modes of existence, is devoid of a non-existent absolute. So, for me, there is, from my point of view, there is no need to emphasize quite specific properties of the other, which we can see in Jamal's thoughts. Since the other is defined as an opposition to reality, and reality is defined not in a way that is total enough, it was defined only by the principle of experience. The other has certain properties, but of course unimaginable. And if it's not clear to someone why I call all these specific statements about another, about the other properties, about this absolute, I am always glad to give a separate answer to this question, and that implies to any other chapter of Jamal's work. So let's move on to Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite. The philosophy of the Areopagite is especially remarkable for us because it is filled with contradictions and intentional contradictions. It is well known that the Corpus Areopagiticum contains both cataphatic writings and a purely apophatic writing on mystical theology. I will not read out his thoughts because it will be more simple to retell the main concept. Areopagite at his first works will present the god's names and attribute a certain properties to him, but in the last work Areopagite will consistently deny lots of properties, among which we will also find those which were presented in the cataphatic part. In other words, God is both goodness and not goodness at the same time, and Godhead and not such, exists and non-existent. We already understand that any extremely paradoxical property is nevertheless a property. Likewise, enumeration of all properties will at best lead us to intuition about everything, but not to intuition about the abyss. It should also be noted that, like long after him Jamal, the Areopagite, if we consider his corpus of texts as a whole, does not abandon some belief in the truth of Christian metaphysics. Apophatic theology is very successful and very radical, but the assumption of some strange thoughts according to which at a certain limit of sacred silence about the divine, the adept can gain thoughts about the ultimate disconnection of God with Christianity, for example, and Christian ethics, as a result of which, when descending back down after the sacred silence, the adept will become, for example, agnostic or occultist, are absent in the text. So Areopagite doesn't consider such an option. And why I mentioned such an option? Because the last author is Matthew Whiteman. Matthew Whiteman, as mentioned, is a little-known Gnostic representing counter-initiate practice. By counter-initiate, I mean primarily Whiteman's focus on radical forms of the left-hand path, which is quite immoral in terms of Christian morality, and aggressive opposition to the God of the Old Testament. The author is known for the series of books, the Ketuve Kodesh Hahol. However, this series of books is still in the process of writing, and some transformations of his metaphysics can be observed. Therefore, without passing judgment on his entire thought, we focus on his early article, The Serpent's Servants, Disciples of Ain, in Clifforth Opus number 3. So, let's see what he writes. Impossibility. A mundane word to some. Difficult to truly imagine in a world where it is often said that anything and everything is possible, even if improbable. We get a glimpse of impossibility when we attempt to imagine true impossibility, the fundamental impossibility of all possibilities. Our imagination comes up against impossibility in this moment and finds that it is indeed impossible to imagine that which cannot be imagined, for imagination is itself founded upon possibility. Nevertheless, true impossibility was one of the infinite possibilities within the void that was beyond all distinction, including that between possibility and impossibility, the void from which the Ein Sof emerged. I call this true impossibility, Ein. In the beginning, before words such as the beginning had any meaning, there was the void of distinction. This was the ultimate regression of transcendence, beyond possibility and impossibility, beyond being and non-being, beyond emptiness and fullness. As part of this fullness emerged two desires, one for possibility and other for impossibility, the fulfillment of either of which would eliminate the void. The two coexisted in perfect balance, however the desire for possibility feared its sibling. It became possessed by anxiety that the other desire would manifest itself first and all would be lost permanently. Driven mad by this anxiety, the desire for possibility manifested itself in such a way that it contained the other desire within itself so that it could thereby be controlled. Thus, the Ein Sof was born. With the manifestation of the Ein Sof, the void of distinction was annihilated, replaced by the actuality of the Ein Sof, who was in all respects identical to the void from which it emerged, entirely, without distinction, except for the fact that it had chosen possibility over impossibility, and therefore contained a single distinction. The Ein Sof was to become the actualized possibility of the true God beyond being, God beyond God, for whom the name God is diminutive. The Ein Sof is the matrix of all possibilities and of all possible relations. It is the limitless depth of the void, absolutely unconditioned and simple, yet it is beyond unity and multiplicity. The Ein Sof is simultaneously without multiplicity or complexity and yet infinitely complex and multiple, or at least the ground of possibility for such complexity. Infinity is insufficient to describe it, as it also contains the possibility for finitude. In its infinity, the Ein Sof also contains Ein, the possibility of no possibilities. No creation, no God, no nothing. This is the ultimate oblivion beyond oblivion, the oblivion of oblivions. So, further in the article, a more nuanced metaphysics of the tradition itself is described, or maybe counter-tradition, I don't know how should we call it, which is of interest, which is not of interest for our analysis. Expressions such as true impossibility was the one of the infinite possibilities within the void. And, quote, in its infinity, the Ein Sof also contains Ein, the possibility of no possibilities, end quote. The fact that the possibility of Ein coexisted with the possibility of Ein Sof within the framework of some difficult to describe construct of void. Finally, the description of Ein as, quote, that where there is no creation, no God, there is no nothing. This is the ultimate oblivion beyond oblivion, the oblivion of oblivions, end quote, are the property mistakes. So these are really radical properties, but they are still properties. They are unimaginable, but still they are properties. So in conclusion, we note once again that metaphysical or ontological work with the categories of everything and the abyss is quite difficult, and I would indicate that a view is possible according to which even the most radical teachings and schools of thought concerning the subject of the abyss could not overcome some of property mistakes. And the second, from my point of view, the basis of non-naive discourse about the abyss can be formulated in the language of contemporary philosophy, even with all requirements of modern academia. So thank you again for listening to me till the end, and I will gladly accept any criticism or suggestions for cooperation. That's all for now.